This is the State of Things live from the Upstage Cabaret in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. There's a certain kind of musician who stays true to his or her passion no matter what the cost. May mean hustling at side jobs or busking on the streets or accepting gigs at odd hours of the day or night. And while that narrative is somewhat romanticized, my guests today are living proof that there's some truth to that story. David Bolton and Logie Meacham are blues musicians who've been playing together for more than three decades. They both have professional careers and so-called day jobs, but they've devoted much of their downtime to being active members in the Piedmont blues scene. And they are just a few of the many musicians documented in the forthcoming book, Bars, Blues, and Booze, Stories from the Drink House. It's a collection of true accounts from musicians, bar owners, and regulars that examines the many forces that shape a local music scene. We're going to hear more from David and Logie in a moment, but I'm joined now by the book's author, Emily Edwards, a professor of media studies at UNC Greensboro. Emily, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
I have been interested in looking at this connection between music and community from a long time, and you come from a place where, you know, you've kind of earned it. You're from Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
I am from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, the Florence area, too.
Yeah. So tell us about that and about your curiosity and where this curiosity emerged.
Well, Lauderdale County in Alabama is a dry county. When I was growing up, it still is a dry county. Florence, which is a city in Lauderdale County, it went wet. Muscle Shoals, you know, it's still dry. So as I was growing up, I knew sort of the whole scene of the drink house. First of all, I should probably tell you that there's drink houses, there's liquor houses, there's shot houses, there's after-hour clubs, there's juke joints, there is bars. So like the blues, a lot of people define these places different ways. So the blues has a lot of people, you know, blues is everything from someone playing a cigar box guitar to, you know, flat out, you know, rock and roll or jazz. So these drink houses all have different kinds of atmospheres. When I was in college, we used to go to house parties, sometimes rent parties, and I had this romantic notion that, you know, music and alcohol and then the right kind of party, it broke down race relations. It was just, you know, it changed the environment, because what I knew from the surface was very different from the kind of environment I had experienced in these house parties. When I started doing this book, I learned that my vision may have been romanticized a little bit, but there was still a kind of feeling I got from that whole experience. People had to do hooch runs to Tennessee, you know, to go bring the liquor back, and people, you know, made their own liquor right there, and we were all breaking the law.
Well, tell us about that, because I think that not only are you breaking the law, but there are a lot of social norms that get broken down mm-hmm. in the process of some of the mixing and mingling that goes on. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, when you're all breaking, and I would be remiss to not mention that there was also other kinds of law breaking going. I mean, there was drugs. We're talking about the 70s when I first had this experience. So when you break one kind of law, it's easier to break another kind of law. And certainly social taboos. And during that period, I think there was an excitement about breaking these social taboos. So going to the drink house or going to a house party and dancing with a black man was exciting. And then to hear the next morning that someone complaining about dirty little black kids swimming in the public pool, you know, there was just an eye-opener. I kept thinking that this was going to change things, because I was very idealistic in those times.
Well, tell us about the project itself, because I know you picked it up and then you put it down for a while.
I did. I started this project in the early 2000s, and hoping to sort of I've had the privilege to know some amazing people, really talented individuals like David and like Logie and like Rob Slater, who's sitting back there, people who are just amazing talents, play great, you know, music, and then they also tell great stories. And I put this in the back of my head, and then at one point I decided, you know, I'm going to collect these and write a book. So I started collecting these back in the early 2000s, and then at one point I got the impression that I didn't have the street cred to really do this book. I was a PhD and I was a girl. And, you know, to hang out in a bar, well, for one thing, ladies, Southern ladies just don't do that, do we? I see a bunch of, we don't do that. So it was.
But a drink house.
But in a drink house, especially. Okay. So we might go to a club, but club. not to a drink house. So I got the impression that I didn't really have the street cred to put this book together, so I put it down. I did some other things that are more scholarly and more appropriate for, you know, a college professor. And I was going at the time to some of the jams locally here in Greensboro at a bar called Zion. And there was a man who was a really beautiful man. His name was Sweet Daddy Ray Burnett. And he used to hang out outside of, in between sets. He ran a lot of the jams, but he would hang out and he would tell stories. And I'm going, oh man, this is, you know, I really do need to pick this back up again. But I just felt like I didn't have the credentials. So I didn't. And then he died. Other people said they were going to come along and write this book, but nobody, I couldn't see anybody doing it. And then he died, and I just really regret that I never recorded some of the really great stories from him, and also some other people that died before I picked it back up. But he called, and that was in 2012, and he caused me to really pick this back up again, and I started really going after the stories and recording as many as I could. One of the reasons why this isn't a documentary, I'm really a filmmaker. One of the reasons why it's a book rather than a documentary is that I could get way more stories in a book than I could get in a documentary, and this book is not long enough to hold them all.
Well, what kind of story? Who were you interviewing, and what were you looking for, and then what weren't you looking for, and that surprised you?
Well, I wanted stories that dealt with what I thought was a Southern, a kind of a widespread Southern culture of liquor laws, and how liquor laws kind of drove these businesses, and how these businesses kind of influenced the music, because musicians would come in, or my experience was that musicians would come into these parties and just break out the guitars and we'd all start to play. And you learned a lot that way. Not me, I didn't progress as a musician, but other people learned a lot.
But you're still a good drinker, though, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm kidding now. I'm joking.
Yeah. we can test that later. But you could learn a lot from looking at some of these older musicians and watch how they played and hear their stories. And so I really wanted to look at how those things influenced the kind of music that people were listening to.
Well, and I don't want to glorify drink in this, but the connection that you're making, and I think it has as much to do with transgression as it does the actual sort of activities that were going on, the idea that it was repressed, that it was illegal. Mm-hmm. And Muscle Shoals, we should point out, for those who don't know, became the source of a great rhythm section, a play started by a guy named Jim Hall and his Swampers. These are all a bunch of white guys who became the rhythm section of the 1970s and turned out some of the greatest music ever. And if you've seen the documentary, you can see the surprise in some of the black artists who came down there when they saw who the Swampers were. But it's precisely that transgression and that sense of you know, misplaced expectations that's the nexus of this
story,
right?
Yeah, that's where kind of some of the connections were made. Rick Hall was very instrumental in the Muscle Shoals sound and Fame Recording Studios and that whole era right there. But I guess one of the stories from that place that really resonated with me was, well, not only did people have to do the hooch runs later on. I have a friend named George Lair who contributes to this book. He used to work at Muscle Shoals Sound. And, you know, you have to go do the hooch run, because after you get done with a session, musicians wanted to have a little relax. And you can't do it in a dry county in an illegal way. But one of the things that stood out in my mind was a story told by David Johnson, who said that they would have these great sessions, and people are not even thinking about racial things. They're laying down this amazing music, and everybody's getting into this music and really, really having a great time. And then after it's all over with, and congratulating themselves on the session, they go out to eat. Okay, so we're in North Alabama. They go out to eat, and they sit down in a restaurant, and they're not getting served. And finally, you know, you're sitting around and sitting around and waiting, watching other people get served. And finally, it took the black musicians to explain, you know, what the problem was. But that too was an eye-opener for me. I guess I had the idealistic idea that this was one way that our culture could really change. I didn't learn until I came to North Carolina that, oh, well, the drink houses were could be highly segregated, self-segregating, and that you wouldn't step foot in a honky-tonk unless you had a death wish. If you were a black person, it's a little easier to go the other way. So I guess I was a little idealistic about it. I also didn't know until I started this book that North Carolina actually had prohibition statewide before the rest of the country initiated prohibition, which was like back in 1908. We had statewide, so we had about a decade of learning how to do the hooch run.
Always in the vanguard, North Carolina.
Yes.
One of the most progressive.
Before the rest of the country got around to it.
Absolutely. Always setting the trend. pretty significant economic story that emerged in this as well, right?
Well, as I was listening to stories, and I thought I was going to be telling one story, when I went back and actually looked at the stories that got into the book, I had to really cut it back because my word count was way over. University Press of Mississippi was very generous in letting me have as many words as I ended up with, but I still had there's enough material out there, by the way, for like five of these books or more. So I had to cut it way, way back. Mm-hmm. But as I was going back and looking at the stories and deciding, you know, what would keep and what my editors really wanted me to keep, there was one theme that emerged in everybody's story, and it was an economic story. It was not about race relations. It was not necessarily about liquor laws, and it was not necessarily about music. It was about economic survival, and which drove a lot of these drink houses appeared. Not only did people want to have a drink, but there was, you know, you had entrepreneurs who said, okay, well, I can open up a house. The thing that surprised me about North Carolina and Guilford County in particular was that Guilford County is wet, but there would still be drink houses, and these were they would be able to stay open past the blue law. They would not pay attention to blue laws, mm-hmm. But they also wouldn't buy the license. You know, mm-hmm. So they could still be shut down. But that was, you know, it was an economic story. It was a story of survival for musicians, and anybody that thinks that being a musician is all fun and games, you know, you read my book, you'll understand that it's hard work.
Well,
it's
we could even talk to a couple of musicians to find out more. I'm talking to Emily Edwards, who's a professor at UNCG, about her book, Bars, Blues, and Booze. And with us on the show are a couple of blues musicians who have been playing together for more than three decades, and they're featured in the book. With me now on the State of Things, David Bolton and Logie Meacham, who you heard just a couple of seconds earlier. Welcome.
Thank you.
David, tell me how you and Logie got together.
Well, it happened in 1982. I had just graduated from Appalachian State and came to Guilford College, and there was a little bar restaurant out there called Huck's, and they had an open jam, and I got up, started to play, and it was my time to quit, but I stayed on stage, didn't I, Logie?
That's the first time he confessed about it was his
fault. You were supposed to leave.
I was supposed to leave. He told that story the other day, but he wouldn't leave.
So what did you do?
And he was sitting there, and he was just jamming, and his time was up. I said, well, he ain't bad. He plays better than I do. So I sat down and just started singing with what he was playing, and we haven't stopped.
It's a great story. Logie, how would you describe the role of the drink house in promoting or in any way being part of the blues scene here in the Piedmont?
Often around this city in particular, there were lots of drink houses years ago inside the city. And there are a lot of people that don't feel comfortable in church. And I've discovered that the drink house was most popular in Guilford County on Sunday morning because people wanted a little hair off the dog. And you couldn't get that. You couldn't wait to 1 o'clock. So there were all over town these little places that on Sunday morning you could go.
Really?
And I had some of my best spiritual experiences Not at the altar. I'm a Methodist with Baptist feet. But I was at a liquor house one Sunday morning, and a man named L.T. Scott, who also was a blues player and hang out with, a lot with Guitar Slim, he came in one day and sang Let It Be. He just lost his wife. And he walked in the liquor house, and he started singing Let It Be. And everybody turned around toward the bar. People, men who are mean enough to chew nails and spit tacks, were crying. Mm. And somebody said around for everybody, and it changed the mood. So there's so much that happens spiritually, and a lot of fun too.
Wow. So, and this is an experience that's going, as you say, Sunday morning. Didn't realize that. But the idea that this is bringing people together, what about the idea of any kind of mixing and social mixing? Was that happening much here?
Liquor houses, particularly young black liquor houses, was not odd for somebody to, for me to bring a David Bolton with me. And people love for him to come. Tim, who built the Music Maker Foundation, that hospitality was always extended to him wherever he went.
Tim Duffy.
Yeah. And how robust was the blues scene here? Was it only in sort of drink houses and places like that where you'd hear the music or parties? I mean, where were we hearing this?
Mostly
music?
In liquor house parties. Yeah. Guitar Slim, Guitar Gabe. There's a man here in Greensboro whose name was Guitar Kimber, and you would find him a lot. And they were always in liquor houses because you could, if you started to play, you could drink free, and you could get a real nice, you know, Sunday morning at Shirley's, you could get a chitlin sandwich. Man. So,
why did anybody go to church? Just thinking. And this is the kind of thing. Were there touring musicians, or was this all kind of was it always a local scene? Maybe I'll ask you, Logie, and then Emily, I'd like to know from you whether one locality might be different than another in terms of attracting talent, or if it was always local scenes.
Most of the time, local guys, but a lot of the local people were connected to family who might have been traveling musicians. Arthur Prysock grew up here in Greensboro and actually from the Terracotta area. So if you were at Shirley's on a Sunday morning, Arthur Prysock might walk in the door, sit down and have a chitlin sandwich and a shot, a 50 cent shot with you.
Wow. That 50 cent got a start here, I think. Are you right? No. I'm going to ask you that question in a minute. I want to hear some music. We're going to actually take a break here, and if y'all would get ready to play for us, we'd love to hear it. We're going to take a break, come back and talk some more about this and hear some more music. We're talking with UNC Greensboro Professor Emily Edwards about her forthcoming book, Bars, Blues, and Booze, Stories from the Drink House, and we'll continue our conversation with her and David Bolton and Logie Meacham. We'll play us out of this segment, and we will be right back. Let's hear some music.
Play it, man. Mm-hmm. Throw it in the alley now. Come on. Oh, you know when it's raining outside? An old blues man going down the railroad track might hear this from the lady at the cabin next door. She say, went down the road, almost didn't get back. Took my last nickel from my nation's sack. And she said, come on in my kitchen, 'cause it's gonna be raining outdoors. I had a girl, she got stole by my friend. Some joker got lucky, took her back again. He told her, say, come on in my kitchen, 'cause it's gonna be raining outdoors. If you see me walking down that road, just trying to bear my heavy load, just tell me, say, come on in my kitchen, 'cause it's gonna be raining. It's got to be raining. It's gonna be raining outdoors.
As David Bolton and Logie Meacham, and they're playing some music for us, and we're going to come right back in just a couple of minutes, and we're going to hear more music from them and more conversation with UNC Greensboro Professor Emily Edwards about her book, Bars, Blues, and Booze, and talk about Piedmont blues and other blues in the South when we come back to the State of Things after this. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about the forthcoming book, Bars, Blues, and Booze, a collection of stories from musicians, bar owners, and patrons of blues bars around the South. Emily Edwards is with me. She's the author of the book and a professor of media studies at UNC Greensboro. I'm also joined by two of the book's featured musicians, David Bolton and Logie Meacham. We've been listening to some of their music. And before the break, Emily, I was talking about how much of this is a local scene and whether or not there was a circuit. And of course, there was a Chitlin circuit, I guess.
There was a Chitlin circuit. And Greensboro was actually, as I understand it, is a little bit before my time, but what people have told me is it was kind of like a major gateway for the Chitlin circuit, for the musicians. There were safe places to stay here, and musicians would stay here, and then as they were traveling south on this circuit. I do have two musicians in the book who actually went. They're a white couple, Penny Zamagni and Rob Houndog Baskerville, who actually went on the Chitlin circuit in search of some of the musicians that they admired. And they admired blues music so much that they wanted to seek these people out. And so they did. And they followed the Chitlin circuit and played on this circuit. So their stories are actually pretty interesting about how it changed the way they saw the world.
Logie, were you ever hanging out for some of those performances?
No, I was very restricted. My grandfather did not know Abraham Lincoln had freed the slaves, so my youth was filled with work from can't see in the morning to can't see at night. And I didn't hang out a lot.
But he did tell me about the Magnolia.
And the Magnolia Hotel was a hotel. I write a story in the 27 Views of Greensboro about the Sweet Magnolia. And the Magnolia Hotel, when I was a little boy going to school on the number 5 Gall Street, you passed there and there was a marquee that said every day the marquee would change names. Staying here tonight, James Brown. Staying here tonight, Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Hmm. Staying here tonight, the 5 Blind Boys. Mm-hmm. So my early introduction to music, in addition to listening, and having musicians come into my home was indeed going by the Magnolia Hotel, which was a safe way for musicians.
How did that circuit work? Were you playing small drink houses? How did they make a living? Did you have to play several gigs in one town in order to? Were there big enough venues?
Chick Willis, who Chick is gone now. He contributed a bunch of stories to this book. So if you're listening, Chick, they finally are getting published. He told me that he would travel from really town to town, and the way you got the work, you didn't do any advertising. Hmm. You went to the barbershop. You might put up a poster or just tell people, and people would come to that bar. You got a cut of the bar, and then you would travel on. And
the barbershop, that's prehistoric social media.
Yeah.
Because in the word, just gets out, right?
Yeah, barbershop. I don't know how his white audiences found out about that to go, but they apparently did too, so.
And was there, on that circuit, was there much race mixing, or would that not be so prevalent?
When Rob and Penny talked about it, they said it was predominantly a black circuit, but they were always welcome to play. In fact, they back up a lot of really traditional kinds of musicians, and they have a blues festival up at Grassy Creek every, I think it's Labor Day. Labor mm-hmm. Day. Yeah, they have this festival where it's not very far from here, and that's an area of North Carolina. You think about it as being more bluegrass than blues, but they have it. There's going to be a new one in Lansing. I'm going to actually be up there with the book, where a lot of several of the people who've contributed to the book are going to be playing at the first Lansing Blues Festival, which is June. When is it? June 18th.
Yeah. We'll put it up on our website. Okay. David and Logie, I wonder if I can get you to play another song for us. You do that?
Yeah. One for Miss Emily called Pretty Girls, Cadillacs, and Some Money. Pretty girl. Cadillac and some money makes a rainy day seem so sunny. Let's do that one more time. A pretty girl, Cadillac, and some money makes a rainy day seem so sunny. I used to know a fella at the grocery store. You look real close, he ain't there no more. He got a pretty girl, Cadillac, Fleetwood, and some money. Makes a rainy day seem so sunny. Now look at here. If you see me and I don't speak to you, don't worry about it, baby, ain't a thing you can do. I got a pretty girl, Cadillac, and some money. Man, I got a pocket full of fun tickets. Makes a rainy day seem so sunny. I used to know a fella at the Harris Teeter store. You go in there shopping, honey, he ain't there no more. He got a pretty girl, Cadillac. He got some money. Makes a rainy day seem so sunny. He got some money for his honey. Got some money. Got to have some cash for your money. Oh, baby, would you like to have a hamburger? I think I'll supersize it. We'll go to McDonald's, girl. I'm gonna treat you good. And some money.
Oh, yeah. Pretty girl, Cadillac, and some money. David Boldman, Logie Meacham. Now, see, that's it. That song is great, and it's a wonderful party song, but in a way, it doesn't strike my ear as typically a blues song, and I think technically it wouldn't be a blues song, but that would be the kind of song that you'd hear in a drink. In other words, does this speak to the diversity of the music that we think of as blues?
It does. A lot of the songs that you hear people, when people say, well, I play blues, they hear songs that have been traditional and recorded and passed on and passed on, but a lot of times when you're in a liquor house, or I spent a lot of time, I was stationed in Mississippi, and you go in drink houses, and quite often the nights that you're there, people make up stuff about what's going on. Here come Mary, she got on that pretty red dress, she out on the floor dancing, she gonna do her best, look out, Johnny's mad. Because Bobby's watching, he going to pull his pistol and we'll all be dodging. I mean, it just... So the spontaneity of the blues gets lost with the tradition, but that quite often does happen.
Spontaneity is an important part of this, and the variety too, Emily. That's some of what you found in the stories, the fact that, you know, like what Logie's saying is it was really in the moment.
Everybody defines the blues differently. Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll hear another sample and we'll decide for ourselves. Will you play us another song?
Sure.
Wonderful.
Let's do Frank Stacio Blues. Let's do that.
That song goes on forever,
but go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, we'll find it now. All these good people came out. We're going to talk about them on the air. Uh-huh. Oh, Walkie Man. Mm-hmm. That's it. I hear. I was out in Greensboro, walking down the street. I heard the blues, Lord, made me pat my feet. Went up the stairs and sat down. Frank was holding court. Got a cup of coffee, went looking for some gin. It was so nice to see my man Stacio again. Emily talked about the blues, baby, we were laying it down. Oh, you got to come to my hometown. Greensboro, Lord, we really getting down. You you got to come sometime to see us in my hometown. Mm-hmm. You know, well, they call it Gate City. Everybody knows when you come to Gate City, Lord, the sun sure enough glows. I got a twinkle in my eye, cause I saw that pretty woman as she passing by. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Take me now, Lord. I have just received the highest honor I ever will. That is my eulogy. That is David Bolden and Logie Meacham with, I guess, the Frank Stay Show Blues.
The Frank Stay Show.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. You know, it also, obviously there's a racial component to all of this. And Emily, you said, you know, you felt a little uncomfortable taking this on, both as a scholar, but also, I think, because of your position as a woman, a white woman. I actually want to put this question to David Bolden as a white man playing in a blues scene, which is perceived to be, you know, part of an African-American tradition. How do you manage that? What do you make of it?
Well, you know, Emily alluded to it earlier. When the music's going and everything, everybody's together, you don't think about the color of somebody's skin. Mm. You're just there to enjoy the music and the vibe. And that's really what it's all about. That's the connecting piece for music for me. You know, and you know, coming into some of these places, we talked a little bit the other day about some of the places that Logie's dragged me into. yeah, the Baptist Church in Harmony, North Carolina, and that was my first chitlin experience. Yeah, with some hot sauce.
Yeah, how are the drinks?
Huh? Yeah. Well, they were sweet.
Yeah, I can say.
You had to go back round back for the punch. It was a little different back around the back of the room. But, we played it for Black History Month. He used to drag me around. And one of the odd places we played was the IRS. Okay, yeah. How do we get a gig at the IRS? I do not know.
You mean like the Internal Revenue
Service? Yes, for Black History Month.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, how he got that gig, I do not know. But
if you're going to sing the blues, that's where to go, right? I mean,
yeah, we sang them, and you can imagine.
Emily, let me ask you a question, too. I mean, you tell a great story early in the book just about the sense of solidarity, at least for white folks, and going back to the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. the sense of being a particularly, you know, sort of hippie kid showing up and wanting to share music.
I think the hippie kids really did embrace this music. They saw it as the founding of rock and roll. And for those musicians that wanted to understand what they were playing better, they went and sought out mentors that could teach them what it was all about. One of the stories I think maybe you're alluding to is the fact that I had known this musician back in the 70s, long hippie with long blonde hair, really wavy long blonde hair, and he complained that he understood what this is really funny. He understood what it was like to be a black man because the cops hassled him and teased him about his hair. So he thought that that meant that he understood and had some sort of solidarity there, but that he was learning blues and was learning to play rock and roll.
I mean, a fine sentiment, and obviously, he can cut his hair.
Yeah. You know? Well, he identified with oppressed women, but with oppressed
black
men.
What about that? What about the role of women in all of this?
They're not. Well, I should say that right now there's a woman in North Carolina named Michelle Seidman who has helped to start Women in Blues, which is a national kind of movement. They do a showcase of just women blues musicians in Memphis every year during the International Blues Blues Competition there. And she's been, there are blues women, a lot of them great blues women, but they're in a minority. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that upset her was not being able to see them as much. And frankly, they're in a minority in my book. Some of it is not because, it was just because they're great artists that wanted to contribute, but for one reason or another, our schedules never worked out. So,
what are your hopes going forward? Now, you talked about more stories than those book covers can.
Well, I guess we'll have to see how this one does and what people think about this one. Like I say, I'm going to be doing a couple of events here in Greensboro. One at the Barnes & Noble, we'll do a music event there with Terry Van Cannon, and then I'm planning one at Scuppernog's, which those of you from Greensboro will know this bookstore. It also sells wine and beer. So we're going to do a little music event there. It'll be an acoustic music event, hopefully, in well, it will be an acoustic event in September, September 18th. We'll be doing that there. And for Scuppernog, that'll be as close to a drink house maybe as a bookstore can get. Anyway.
We'll post all that on our website. I want to thank all of you so much for being on the program. UNC Greensboro Professor Emily Edwards, the author of the forthcoming book, Bars, Blues, and Booze, Stories from the Drink House. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Dathan Bolton and Logie Mitchum are blues musicians. They've been playing together for a long time. We're going to let them play us out, but first I think we should hear it for them. They've been playing more than three decades. I want to tell you about the state of things. It's from North Carolina Public Radio. It is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director, with Al Wadarski helping out today. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, David Bolton and Logie Mitchum.
Big balls, man. Can't you hear me when I call? Big boss man. Can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big, boy. You just tall, my man, that's all. Well, you got me working, boss man, working around the clock. Well, I want me a drink of water, boy, but you just won't let me stop. Say, big boss man, can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big. You just tall, my man, that's all. I'm gonna find myself a boss man, one gonna treat me right. I'm gonna work hard in the daytime, baby, just rest easy at night. Now, big boss man, oh, can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big, boy. You just tall, my man, that's all. Well, now one of these days, my baby, I won't have to work like a slave no more. Gonna buy myself a Cadillac, move down to the Carolina shore, big boss man. Can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big, boy. You just tall, my man, that's all.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you.